jazz.
Busted.
Right. Anyway, can't wait for that. Oh, boy. Hoo doggy, are we ready for the fourth and final, except we're probably going to do a cleanup episode where we talk about some suggestions from our readers and listeners. We don't have
that
readers.
Sounds good.
I'm running out of words. Are we ready for the final installment of our look back at the 2010s? This is podcast 204 of the Jazz Bastard podcast. Mike's Mike, Pat's Pat. And we've done something old, something new, something borrowed. Now we're on.
Is this where I'm supposed to say something blue?
I hope so, because really something there's blue. Nobody else here. So if you don't say
something
it, I don't
blue.
Say it.
I didn't know if you were waiting for me to say something. So
you know, the third party's never going to appear. Yeah, and it was kind of your idea that maybe we should look at a number of releases on the storied label Blue Note appeared on these best of 2010 lists we looked at. And then there was a ringer in that there was an album by J.D. Allen on Savant Records, called Americana Musings on Jazz and Blues. So that's 2016 joint. And what are the other Blue Note releases, the actual Blue Note releases we're doing from the 2010s?
Yeah, Lovers by Nils Klein. And then Concentric Circles by Kenny Barron, astonishingly for this dean of the form, his first release ever on Blue Note, which I just found out. And then did we say J.D. Allen? No, we didn't. Blue Note All-Stars, which is a thing they do from time to time. They have the hip young new cats cut an album, and Don was the current leader consigliere of Blue Note, arranged for some of, I would say, the usual suspects, except they're, you know, they're good. It's just when you hear their names, you'd be like, oh yeah, those guys, you know.
Yeah, the kind of hardcore wing of Blue Note's roster.
Yeah. Right.
No Nora Jones.
That's right. Nothing. No. Can I say it? No crap. Yeah.
I like Nora Jones more than you do. So yeah, Blue Note All Stars, Our Point of View on Blue Note, of course, 2017. Kenny Barron, Concentric Circles, Blue Note 2018, Nels Klein, Lovers, Blue Note 2018, and then again, J.D. Allen's Americana, Musings on Jazz and Blues and Savant Records, 2016. So the second half of the 2010s, four releases, three on Blue Note, one with the word blues in its title.
Yeah, and we like it, so it seems we're fine.
Yeah. And at least one listener asked us to do another J.D. Allen joint, or to do one. Not every listener has listened to all of the podcasts. And I you know, remember, you're not a true fan unless you listen to one through 203. Oh, God.
Until you've made your own spreadsheet cross-listing all of the references.
Please don't do that. Yeah. Just listen to whatever you fucking well please. So do you have a preference as to where we begin?
None whatsoever. You're driving. I'm just along for the ride.
Beep, 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 beep. Someday I'll have a car, baby, you can... Okay, I don't remember those lyrics. But the Beatles were pretty good. Let's maybe begin with J.D. Allen. This trio album, Americana, Musings on Jazz and Blues. J.D. Allen is on tenor saxophone, Greg August on bass, and Rudy Royston. Rudy's all over the map right now in jazz. He's a very big player on the scene on drums.
Did we do one of his albums, or we just happened to get it?
I think both we've done one by his wife, which I was super fond of, and I think we did one that he was a leader on.
Flatbed Buggy.
There you go. Okay, so Shamey Royston's Beautiful Liar we did back on 142. I think it's an excellent album. Her husband was on drums on that one. And then Flatbed Buggy was episode 150, and that was led by Rudy Royston.
Yeah.
So the Royston Dynasty we've touched on before. Though I, you know, for me, this particular album, I don't think that Royston is, he's certainly effective, he's good, but I don't feel like he's particularly featured or dominant on it. I feel like this is mainly J.D. Allen's show. What do you think of this trio joint?
Oh, absolutely. I do think it's a J.D. Allen show. It's interesting as a kind of prospect because, nominally a trio date. The sound is good. You can hear the bass. It's great. You don't have to live in your earphones to hear it. I still feel like it's primarily the JD show. Royston, I think, is featured a little more prominently of the trio behind Allen, except there are some arco portions on bass, and then that's where the bass player really stands out for me. But yeah, this is really just kind of JD Allen. The title of the album, you know, it's really, you know, the contents of the box are as described on the label, you know. It's musings, which implies a kind of meditative noodling. Musings is like, you know, thoughtful ruminations, but not, you know, doctrinal statements. It's kind of like, I got some thoughts about jazz and the blues, so I'm going to play them for you. It has a kind of casual ad hoc feel, and the whole album kind of has that. There are a couple of, you probably know better than I do, there's several originals here, but there's a bunch of covers. Or are they all covers?
You know, I don't know. My sense is, I mean, this could also be called some Coltrane shit, right? I mean, it is remarkably Coltrane-esque. And Royston, in a way, he seems over-equipped for what he's doing in this. I mean, Royston's an amazing drummer, but it seems like he's using 10% of his superpowers. Certainly a couple of the tunes, like Bigger Thomas. Is the Giant Steps chord changes, right? You know, so it's not a cover per se, but it's a very simple theme that's based on these very famous jazz chord sequence that Coltrane was best known for doing. I think some other musicians had experimented with it before, such as Herbie Nichols, but Coltrane was the one who popularized it. And, you know, JD runs down some Coltrane-esque licks at a little bit slower pace on, you know, from Giant Steps on this thing. And then Lightning's another one that I can't remember, but it's, you know, it's based on another kind of Coltrane riff or chord sequence. So, yeah, I don't know whether they're covers per se or just he's drawing on these basic frameworks that Coltrane made famous and popularized and using and much more strikingly than I feel like on the other J.D. Allen album we talked about. This is a very Coltrane-esque approach. I listen to it and I think, you know, I think Train.
Right. Well, I hear some of that. The instrumentation reminds me a little of Coleman, Ornette Coleman because he did a similar sort of pianoless quartet, or I guess, as we would put it, a trio. But I was struck by the geniality of much of this. Musings has a kind of, you know, I don't want to waste too much time pondering the title, but it fits what's here. So, I mean, you mentioned Bigger Thomas, so let's talk about that. It's sort of half-speed Giant Steps in some ways, right? I mean, it's not the same. It's the chord changes, but it's a different, you know, he's playing different licks, but not at Coltrane's pace. It's at a more relaxed, leisurely pace. But Bigger Thomas is the title, there's the main character in Richard Wright's Native Son, a searing, powerful indictment of race issues in the United States, right? And Bigger Thomas is this amazing kind of character that Richard Wright wrote, who is, he's a bad guy. Bigger Thomas is a bad guy. He kills a couple of people and, you know, he gets put on trial and, you know, he's sentenced to death for the horrible things that he's done. Right. And Wright specifically wrote this because he initially wrote like a novel that was like, you know, how a young black man is destroyed by the system, but he's innocent. And he realized that didn't really tell. That just made liberals happy. And so he wrote a much more sharp, angry novel about a young black man who's destroyed, but is not innocent. He's actually, you know, a product of his environment. He's a dangerous, angry young man. So you'd expect a dangerous, angry song. but it's kind of in a major key. It's this kind of da 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 da. You know, it's very, it's peppy. It's kind of warm. It's like Bigger Thomas on a happy day walking down the streets of Kensington. You know, it's chill. It's not angry Bigger Thomas, you know, killing someone. And I was kind of struck by that. I was like, that's kind of the feel of the whole album, right? Even a song like Another Man Done Gone is not this kind of plaintive. I mean, it's, you know, a blues, but it's not this plaintive, aching. It's kind of a meditative, thoughtful rumination, playing with the form. This is playful in a kind of thoughtful, meditative way, the whole album, which, you know, is in a kind of sweet spot for me. I really enjoy this. We've talked about this kind of thing before. If I pay a lot of attention, you know, I find this very rewarding. But I'm also equally happy just letting it run in the background.
Yeah. It's not super demanding. Yeah,
it's not demanding. Like, I just thought, Bigger Thomas, I thought, okay, this is, here we go, angry. And I'm like, this isn't angry. This is mellow. It's not mellow, but it's...
Bigger be chillin', yeah.
I was expecting, you know, minor key fury. And it was like, da-da-da-da-da. I mean, you can't name a song Bigger Thomas and not call up Richard Wright's Native Son, among other things. So the whole album strikes me this way, which I found it very, very enjoyable, both as background and as concentrated upon as foreground. And yeah, it's what the damn title says, Musings on Jazz and Blues. It's musings. That's what it is.
Right,
it's not statements. Yeah. It's not doctrine. It's not a manifesto. It's like, let me tell you some things I've been thinking lately. It's like a notebook. And I enjoy it at that level. There's something unprepossessing about this, unprogrammatic, undemanding in the sense of, you know, here's an agenda. It's thoughtful. I don't know. I like it quite a bit.
Yeah, what it reminds me of, and it suffers a bit in the comparison, is Clifford Jord's Glass Bead Games, in that it is this, he is a somewhat pensive, he is not a technically elaborate player, you know, he's somebody that kind of straightforward statements, you know, that in that particular case reach a kind of sublimity. And yeah, I mean, this is, to me, it's kind of, you know, a calmer, meditative, less technically fraught Coltrane approach. It's not tortured. It's not technically a powerhouse, but it's, you know, in the best version of it, certainly in Glass Bead Games, which is a classic, you know, nourishing, it's touching, you know, but it's not quite that intensity that Coltrane has.
Right.
And, you know, this is that way to me. I don't think it's quite as successful as the Jordan album, which is this minor classic that a lot of people don't know about. It's just a fantastic record, and I'll tell you, I got an LP version of it, and that's even sexier. It's just unbelievably great sounding. So, you know, I like this. I think that it did seem oddly, and I think quite intentionally, in this mode of, this is like Coltrane. You know, I mean, it really comfortably sitting in a way that we did his Radio Flyer album on Savant, on 140. And that one, I mean, certainly he's someone who's known as playing in this mold, but this album struck me more that this is just very Coltrane-esque. I don't think it quite catches fire. You know, I was trying to compare Rudy. It's not fair, but of course you're going to be thinking about Elvin Jones. And he doesn't quite bring the thunder that Elvin would at times. Again, I'm not saying he was expected to or he should have. I've loved and really just, you know, think Rudy's a fantastic drummer. I just don't know that this particular case he's allowed to shine that much. And I did also think, you know, as a trio, you're especially a little bit skeptical of McCoy Tyner's contributions to the Coltrane Quartet. I was listening. There's a recent pressing of Love Supreme, which is pretty fucking fantastic. And there is an element that he adds. I guess I'm saying that maybe a piano player might not have been out of place here. You know, just one more voice or maybe another horn or maybe just something. It is a little just plain spoken. It's certainly he's the last thing from trying to show off. It's the opposite of showing off. It is just, here's what I'm trying to say. As you say, you know, musings, whatever you want to say, it's kind of a very unpretentious, straightforward, here's where I'm at. Here's what I'm thinking about. Coltrane was pretty fucking cool, wasn't he? Here's some licks. You know, here's some changes you might recognize from Coltrane's many recordings. You know, I liked it, but it, to some degree, this was true of the Christian Scott album we talked about, where you had these very politically charged titles, but when you listen to the music, there's nothing about it as music, emotionally or in terms of intensity, that would alert you that this is about a politically charged subject. It's pretty easygoing, pretty pleasant. So, you know, the title's doing all the heavy lifting there, politically speaking. So I liked it. But yeah, it was surprisingly in a certain bag and maybe for me lacking a little bit of fire. But I don't know that he was trying to get you on fire. I mean, as you say, I think it's very, as you say, an album of musings. So I enjoyed it, but it wasn't revelatory. And, you know, I probably, Radio Flyer might have been a little bit more interesting to me, finally.
I think I might have liked this a little bit more than Radio Flyer. Sure. Didn't Radio Flyer have a guitarist or something? Wasn't Liberty Elman on that or something?
You know, I think he was. I'm going to check online because I don't remember.
I can check faster than you can.
All right, you win the prize then. I'll let you just do that.
Yeah, he was. It was Liberty Elman. I knew there was a guitarist. I couldn't remember who it was. I think I like this a little better than Radio Flyer.
Well, Lord knows Liberty Elman is the furthest imaginable musician from the Coltrane crew. You know, no, there's nothing, there's no point of similarity. And I like Elman's playing quite a bit, but it absolutely does not remind me of anything to do with the Coltrane, the modal groove, the loping triplets. It's just not
right. That. And, you know, another thing that I thought about that's worth mentioning in this context, and it's Liberty Elman who brings it to mind. With a lot of these albums we've been looking at, we looked at some seniors of the form, but a lot of them have been, you know, young guys, especially this week, a lot of young guys. J.D. Allen is not a young guy. He's not the next hot young thing. He's been around. He's done a bunch of albums. He and Liberty Elman are like the same age, and Elman has been in a Zoid with Henry Threadgill for fucking ever. J.D. Allen is not, you know, he's not a senior statesman, but he's not a young lion either.
Yeah, he's 72, born 72. So, yeah, he's a middle-aged dude.
Yeah, he's kind of, you know, in the prime of his career, and he's recorded a lot of albums. And, you know, if anyone's entitled to make an album called Musings, you know, I think it's him. And I like his musings. When he's ready to make a doctrinal statement, I'll be ready to hear that one, too, I think.
Yeah, I think there's no question that for the jazz press and people that are into the music, you know, he's earned his oats. He's stuck to his guns. He's a guy that has played the kind of music he thinks is appropriate to play for a good long time. He's the furthest thing imaginable from a sellout, quote unquote. He is working in the vineyard. A fine, solid outing, but not one to convert me into a fanatical fan.
Right.
How about, what do you think about going to Kenny Barron next, and that the other two albums are kind of more production?
Yeah.
Kenny's born back in 1943, so he's not a young
man. He's an old man.
Yeah. So he's leading here a bog standard Blue Note quintet. Dana Stevens, tenor sax, Mike Rodriguez, trumpet, Jonathan Blake, drums, Kiyoshi Kitagawa.
That sounds good. Good job.
Bass. I just try to say all the letters and see what happens.
If you do, you're in good shape. That's excellent. I think you did a great job.
Normally, I substitute or add letters. My mind is incapable of reading names. Anyway, this is a quintet album, the old Blue Note lineup of trumpet, tenor, drums, bass, and piano. Kenny has been working in the vineyards for a lot longer than J.D. Allen or anybody else really on the show. I don't know. Concentric circles. I gotta check. Did Greg Ospie also have an album called that? Or did, you know, it's a little generic isn't quite the right word, but it's one of those things. It is uncommittal. What kind of music could be in here? Well, the concentric circles. You know, it's I think a very solid release. What do you think of concentric circles?
I think it's a very solid release. Didn't we do a Kenny Barron album on a previous podcast not that long ago?
Let me check. Maybe we did something. I don't recall. Just keep talking. What else do you think about it?
I feel like we did, and I think when we did him at the time, I can recall myself saying, I haven't grokked Kenny Barron, and I feel like I should have because he's been around for a long time. He's gigged with all kinds of giants and is rightfully considered, you know, a living legend in his own right, not simply by virtue of having, you know, lived the ripe old age of 73 or 74, but also because, you know, he's the career, you know, the body of work, both as sideman and as leader. So it is kind of striking that this is his first leader date on Blue Note.
Right. So we've done Kenny Cox. We've done Kenny Drew, the piano player. Kenny Garrett. We've even done Kenny G. But aside from an appearance on, I think we did People Time by Stan Getz, and that's a duet album towards the very end of that great tenor player's life. Kenny Barron is the other musician on it. So he is kind of a co-star of that record. We've not done
that's kind of where I know him from as a co-star.
Yeah, we've not done the leader date. Yeah, well, he is. He's a consummate sideman kind of guy.
Yes. There's a Tommy Flanagan, Kenny Barron record called Together that I have, which is really good. I've got Green Chimneys here somewhere. But he does a lot of these sort of dates with other people. Who is on? Is it Wanton Spirit? Was that the one you were referring to just now? It's got Roy Haynes and Charlie Hayden.
As I said, we have not on the podcast done a Kenny Barron leader date. The closest we've come is People Time with Stan Getz, where obviously Stan Getz is the headliner, but Kenny Barron's the only other musician on it. So, you know,
I've got, I don't know, 10 or 12 of his CDs.
Wow,
I've got a pair. Yeah, I've got a bunch. I've got a date with Dave Holland called The Art of Conversation. There's a disc called Sambao, another called Another Places with people like Victor Lewis and Bobby Hutcherson. You know, he's played with everybody. So, you know, that he finally gets his Blue Note debut at the age of, what is he, 76, 77, something like that?
Yeah, the only album I've got is Scratch, where he co-leads with Dave Holland and Daniel Humer. So I just, I don't have Kenny Barron. I mean, nothing against the guy. I'm not trying to rip on him. I just don't.
I don't know how I ran across him or where how he hit my radar screen. But like I said, I'm counting them up here. This is 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8.
We've done Kenny Wheeler. We've got a lot of Kennys, but Kenny Cox, we haven't done Kenny.
I've got his Live at Maybach Recital Hall volume.
All right. Yeah. Well, you know, as a piano player, you get your chance to do one of those if you're lucky. Yeah.
So here's my feeling about this. I kind of wanted to call this Where's Kenny?
He's behind Waldo there.
Where's Kenny? They killed Kenny. And these are mostly originals, and I don't know how you felt, but I thought they were interesting. I can't hum any of these songs.
They're pleasant. Right, exactly.
They're pleasant.
They're good, solid jazz originals that you're going to forget after you hear them, yeah.
And it feels like there's just a lot of space for the frontline horns.
Thank you.
and they're good. And I sometimes I'm like, where's Kenny? Where's Kenny? I want to hear more Kenny. And because I can say that because I've got other albums with Kenny on them, and I kind of like Kenny. I can't identify Kenny's style or Kenny's
right
key modes, because, you know, I just haven't honed in enough on him. But if this was the only Kenny Barron album I had, I would find it really, really hard to grok him. Maybe concentric circles is a way of saying I'm at the center of all of these concentric circles.
Well, it's just the Blue Note tradition, which is you can't hear the fucking piano player. I mean, the classic Blue Note Van Gelder's, the piano just, you urinate in it before recording. I remember a Bud Powell session, like, is he the leader? Because all I can hear is Sonny Rollins. And yeah, and it's a kind of a soft focus. I mean, none of the recording, one thing that Gelder was brilliant at in the pomp of Blue Note was getting a kind of immediacy with the horns. I mean, just like they're just fucking in your lap.
Right.
You know, that tenor, that trumpet, they're in the room with you on those recordings. And, you know, he was really good with cymbals, decent with drums. The bass would come and go. And the piano was just always kind of muffled and off to the side for the most part. There are exceptions, you know, obviously. Herbie Hancock gets his licks in, it sounds okay. But, you know, that was not his strength. And yeah, here, I hadn't thought of it quite that way, but you're right. He's kind of a recessive presence, isn't he?
Right. Yeah. I don't want to make it sound like you can never hear him, right? The title cut, Concentric Circles, features him. He kind of gets the first takeout of, you know, it's a hard bop lineup. And even though these aren't hard bop songs,
it's a hard
you get
bop
some statements,
life.
Okay. And then you get, you know, everyone kind of gets to take the tune out for a spin, and Kenny gets first spin in concentric circles, and he's fine. That's cool. But yeah, when anyone else, when either the frontline players are playing, Kenny is recessed even beneath the bass and the drums, it feels like to me. And I kind of wish he wasn't. He is more prominently featured on this. I don't even know how to pronounce it. I mean, I don't know if it's I don't know. Akela Frevo Axe. I don't know. It's sort of Latin tinged number, and I can hear him a little better there because he's kind of upfront on that, and also on Baile. The piano seems to be more prominent at times. But yeah, as soon as the horns start, the rhythm section, especially the piano, feels like it's recessed, and you know, that's fine, that's okay. It's generous. But I guess I would have liked to have heard even more Kenny than I did. I don't know. It's a minor complaint for an album that I find perfectly enjoyable. You know, there's nothing here that I dislike.
Yeah, 66 minutes of kind of mainstream, modern mainstream goodness. It doesn't knock you on your ass. You know, he ends with a solo rendition of Reflections by Thelonious Monk, which is just interesting. One thing that fascinates me about records is, like, why do I like certain records more than others? And one, like, I picked up this pretty obscure Gary Burton album with a little known quartet he had with Steve Swallow all over it. I'll probably send you a copy at some point. I might even ask to do it. We'll see. And it's like, you know, what makes this album interesting to me? Well, one, Steve Swallow's all over the fucking place. I mean, he just gets incredible solo space. He's as loud as Burton. And then, you know, they do Isfahan by Duke Ellington, and they do Reactionary Tango by Carla Bley. And out of the six songs, you know, those are two very distinctive songs that most people don't play, and they give the album a character. You know, it's like, I know this record. I've never heard anybody else cover this. It's a centerpiece of social studies, which might be Carla Bley's greatest album. It's certainly up there. And, you know, of course, Steve Swallow was on that recording, and now he's on this one, and he gets a solo all over the fucking place. I mean, if you want bass, I got to get you this recording, because Steve Swallow's like, yeah, the engineer, he's mine. He's my bitch. I'm making him twice as loud. Yeah. And it's just awesome. I love Steve Swallow. But when you cover Monk, at this point, you aren't saying shit. everybody covers. And I'm not saying Kenny Barron hasn't earned his love of Monk, but it's just not a number that if you cover at the end of a record in the 2000s, anybody's going to remember you did, because every fucking buddy does Monk. You need to do something else. If that's your solo spot, you got to show something idiosyncratic or unique about your personality. And who was a great model for that? Thelonious fucking Monk, who would play There's Darkness on the Delta or I'm Just a Gigolo that no one else ever played. You know, it's like you've got to find some way to express your individuality. And I love Monk. I mean, don't get me wrong. But as a piano player, if you do a Monk cover, you haven't said shit, because every fucking piano player in jazz does Monk covers now. So that, I feel like that's kind of symptomatic of the album, which I like. I think it's a good one. I think it's pleasant. It's kind of, again, it's kind of a modernized, perhaps a little bit slicker, a little bit softer focused version of the classic Blue Notes. But you need something a little more idiosyncratic to stick. And I guess he's known as Love in Latin. And I feel like when the Latin number comes on, the energy level, it's not that it gets louder or faster or anything, but it's just the intensity level, maybe is a way of putting it, seems to crank up just a degree. It's like he really is getting into this. He likes this. And then I like it because I get that feeling through it. So, yeah, it's a good record. Was it one of the best 100 albums or 20 albums of the 2010s? I don't know. You know,
I feel like it's a participation trophy again. I like this album, but I have a handful, I don't know, a 10 or 11 Kenny Barron albums, and I still don't have a handle on his voice the way I do on some other players. I always like him, but I like other stuff better. Maybe because I've lived with it longer. I like Sam Bao and Wanton Spirit better. Maybe because I've lived with them longer.
Possibly.
And when I've lived with this longer, I'll like it better. I'm going to disagree with you slightly on Reflections. I do like that Monk cover. I did feel like there was some individual personality there.
Yeah, that's fair. I don't want to say that there was no. I did. It's right. More the choice of tune. Not that he did a bad job with it, just that...
He does different voicings on it. I feel like he goes into a little stride sometimes. He's got... It's like his own little take, and he does kind of take the tune out in a couple of places, you know, so I dug that, actually. I was like, okay... This is a Monk cover, but it's his cover, and I could, you know, it's
well, doesn't you can sound hear him too. I mean, is Kenny at forefront, where so much of the record, as you say, he's recessed. So
it felt like he was
that's fair.
Behind. So yeah, I like it a little bit better because I have a real sense of him there, you know. And as I said, I think I tend to have him more in duo settings or where he's one of two kind of headliners, and so I'm used to hearing him much more sort of centrally located, as it were. But yeah, he's a guy that I feel guilty about, that I'm like, I should know more about. I should like it. You know, what I have by him, I like. It's just that it's not like someone who we've listened to a gazillion times, like Bobby Hutcherson.
Right.
But he's of the same, he's roughly the same generation. Yeah. And
well, he's like, let's think, he's 40. I mean, I'm trying to think whether he's, how
he's
much?
He's 77. So.
77. So he's really, he's not that much younger than like a Herbie Hancock.
Right.
I tend to think of him, so he's 43. What is Dear Herbie? I tend to think of him as like part of that generation right after Hancock and Korea. No, I mean, Hancock's 40, so I mean, they're just 3 years apart.
Right.
But in terms of making your reputation and becoming a known figure, I feel like Hancock is on the scene and known a little earlier. And for me, you know, when you get even to Hancock's, you know, really Barron's generation, it's those the modern accomplished piano players that came up in the 60s and forward. It takes me a long time to sort out even them. I mean, I've gotten to the point where, you know, Hancock at his best is very recognizable in Korea. But, you know, that took me years in a way that saxophone players or trumpet players, it's just easier, I feel like, to make a distinctive sonic fingerprint on a wind instrument. At least for somebody who's not as attuned to the subtleties of piano playing. And it took me longer to sort out, like, you know, not like a Monk or somebody, you know, after a couple records, you know them every single fucking time. Bud Powell, whatever. But that later generation where there was kind of that almost step change in technical accomplishment, a little harder for me.
All right, let's turn to Niels Klein.
Perfect choice.
Yes, because I'm getting sleepy, and this is nighttime music for tired people.
Oh, so Niels was born in 1956, and I was, you know, this is a big production, right?
It is. Can I do the list? I want to do the list. Let me do the list.
Do it.
So, on trumpet, flugelhorn, cymbalon, celeste, and arranger and conductor, Michael Leonhardt, the son of Jay Leonhardt, and son also of Donna Leonhardt of Bein' Green. Jay Leonhardt, the longtime bass player for Mel Torme.
And he's been involved with Steely Dan, right?
Devin Hoff on bass, Alex Klein, Nels' brother, on drums and percussion. Steven Bernstein, I think we've talked about him before. He plays a whole bunch of stuff. Trumpet, slide trumpet, I don't know what that is. Flugelhorn, and something called an alto horn. Taylor Haskins, trumpet, flugelhorn, valve trombone. Alan Ferber, trombone, bass trombone. Charles Pillow, all kinds of reeds. Alto, C, and bass flute, oboe, English horn, alto, and B something clarinet, B flat, B sharp, B flat something.
This is great because it's like a couple years ago, we had no idea who Charles Pillow is. Now we've done a couple of his records and it's like, you see that name? It's like, we know Charles. You go, boy.
He's been everywhere. J.D. Perrin, I think we've done one of his albums. He plays flute and clarinets and baritone and bass saxophones. Don't get bass saxophone very often. Ben Goldberg playing clarinets here. Douglas Weiselman also playing clarinets and tenor sax. Gavin Templeton, clarinet and sax. Sarah Schoenbeck, bassoon. Not nearly enough bassoon in jazz.
See, my listing, for some reason, is all these same people, but the instruments are in Italian. And so my listing is Sarah Schoenbeck, fagotto, which apparently is Italian for a bassoon.
Yeah, flageolet back in the Middle Ages. Julian Lage, I don't know how to pronounce it. We've done one of his albums on guitar. Kenny Wallison on vibraphone, marimba. Zena Parkins, harp. Yuka Honda, celeste. Antoine Silverman, Jeff Gaultier, Amy Kimball.
Yuka's wife, right? You know, she was.
That's right. Oh, that's right.
Pop album that we did. Album.
That is correct. Yeah. And then some string players. Eric Friedlander probably is the biggest name here. He's been in some of the Masada string events for John Zorn. He plays cello. Maggie Parkins plays cello. Stephanie Griffin plays viola. Amy Kimball, viola and violin. And then Antoine Silverman and Jeff Gaultier. And I think Gaultier, we've done something.
Yeah, well, there was a period.
Playing violin. Those guys are on violin.
Go ahead. Label called Cryptogramophone. Yes. I think of as a West Coast label that the Kleins were on, the Gaultier was on, and they made a lot of just kind of really solid music. You know, I mean, it was really good stuff. Niels Klein Singers was on it, and E-Music at one period carried some or all of their catalog, and there's just a number of very good albums that kind of mix electricity and folk and jazz from, I don't know, 15, 20, 25 years back.
Yeah, so here's my beef with this. I've had this for a while. I'm going to tell you what it reminds me of. So years ago, I was on a music trading service, the much lamented and short-lived Alala. That's what it was called, Lala. Yeah. And Lala, briefly, in an effort to hold the interest of the people who were on this music trading website, Lala let us program our own radio stations. Lala basically got some gig, some deal where you could queue up songs and then put them in like a listing, right? So I queued up some of my favorite jazz songs and had them in a listing, and someone said, "I love your radio station. It puts me to sleep like nothing else." I was like, you bastard. You know, I was like, some Meldow and some other things I loved. And I'm like, what do you mean it puts me to sleep? How dare you? You know, I was so mad. I was like, he said it was a great cure for insomnia. And it wasn't a compliment. So Nels Klein's album, Lovers, to me, is a brilliant cure for insomnia. This is the ultimate put it on late at night and drift. There's nothing here that's going to wake you up. It's like orchestrated. You know, so you think of Nels Klein as this angular, self-taught, amazing wild card that made Wilco relevant for a while. And this is like orchestrated to within an inch of its life. It's not a puppy humping your leg. It's a cat curled up on your lap. The whole thing. It's very pleasant. It's extremely, extremely enjoyable. But it's also absolutely unchallenging in every way as far as I'm concerned. Like, I love this. I think it's great. But none of it pushes me. None of it makes me go, ouch, that hurts. What am I doing? The whole thing is just, it's like Nels Klein listened to the Great American Songbook and decided, I want to make an album from the gasp. He's going to pick songs that are a little bit, you know, the most in the pocket thing here is Glad to Be Unhappy. And then it's a lot of stretched out, you know, stuff that's a little less common. Some
covers are of pop songs and some are,
Right. And so I enjoy it. I listen to both discs. It's a long thing. I listen to both discs. And, you know, not once does Nels shred. You know, it's contemplative and moody and groovy. And it's like, it's the kind of album that you would listen to in a post-coital haze after the fever, after the lovin's gone. You put on Nels Klein's Lovers and fall asleep in a Vaseline-lensed haze of post-coital sweat dissipating softly into the pastel sheets. It's that kind of album. Totally likable, completely without like edge or angle or nothing that makes you go, ouch, that hurt.
Right, yeah.
And I guess I want it to hurt once in a while. I want to be challenged, and this is not challenging to me. I don't know. I feel like this is pleasant and disappointing all at the same time.
You think the dagger through the heart is promising what it doesn't deliver, huh?
can something be pleasant and disappointing simultaneously? Because that's how I feel about this.
Well, you know, when I was listening to it, a couple things occurred to me. One is that I have, you know, Plato made this distinction, I think it was Plato, between knowledge and true opinion, where knowledge is, you know, you really know something, and true opinion is just you happen to be right. And I feel like at the moment, I just, maybe I've got a true opinion that I like this record, but I don't really have knowledge of it because I haven't been able to sit down and crank up the stereo and just focus on it. And I feel like the devil's in the details here. It's as much about the arrangements and the subtleties of the chords and the orchestrations as it is anything else. You know, it's not necessarily about Nels himself shredding. It's very much about this presentation of these fancy arrangements. And, you know, the other thing that occurred to me is that going into this record, Nels has got a certain reputation, and that is of a skronker, of a shredder. And so he just wants to play pretty, but he's kind of doing that knowing, in a sense, or faced with a problem right. that his audience expects something a little more avant-garde, a little bit more surprising, and he just doesn't seem interested in that.
Yeah.
You know, and it's... Again, well, I think I suspect the fiber such as there is in the subtleties of the orchestration. And again, I don't feel like I've been able to do those justice. You know, it just, it really is something I'd have to sit down and just very carefully listen to.
Right.
And, you know, I can enjoy it and get the gist of it working on my drafting at work. But to get really sort of the Gil Evans-esque chord changes and the little quirky details that he adds to it. You know, another guitar player who has kind of gone down this road on a much longer term basis is Bill Frisell, right?
Of course. And that's the next thing I was going to say. This sounds like Bill Frisell on a quiet day. You know, the closest thing to a builder here, because so, you know, Bill Frisell can do this sort of stuff, but on every one of these, he'll throw in like that Madonna song. What's that song? Oh, shit, I can't remember it.
I know what you mean, but I can't remember.
There's a Madonna ballad that he throws in, and he just tears it up without shredding. It just builds and builds. There is one Bill Frisell builder on here, and it's the final cut on disc two, The Bond, which just is this slowly escalating chord change thing that, you know, just kind of keeps rising and elevating. And it's the closest Nels gets to shredding. He doesn't really shred. He picks over this lush, lavish, gorgeous set of chords, the chording from the whole orchestration behind him. And I love the song. I absolutely love it. And I could just listen to him doing that for a half an hour in a live concert and have an orgasm as he did it, you know, because it's just this slow building, you know, major key. It sounds like a benediction, you know? And I bet live, I would just lose my mind listening to that. And I love it here, too. But the whole album is very much, you know, it's in the orchestration. It's very pleasant. I like it very much. It's just, it feels fiber-free compared to his other stuff, which is often challenging and thorny and difficult. And this is just soft lens, Vaseline, chill music. I mean, this is chill music. For people who think Nels Klein hurts, this is the album to get, because this doesn't hurt at all. I mean, not at all.
Yeah, well, I think there's you know, as I said, there's quirk around the edges. I don't think it's not quite just with strings, straightforward ballad readings. I think that's what he wanted them. I mean, the guy is not a kid.
Right.
You know, he was born back in 56, so he's, you know, 64 or so. And he just may have decided, I like to make a late night record that's romantic, despite the fact that the cover of it is a dagger going into a heart. Again, I think that I have not felt like I've had a chance to immerse myself in it enough to know, are the trappings and the wrappings and the arrangements just quirky, or is there some real interest there? And I don't feel like I'll know the answer to that question until I've sat down with it pretty loud, nothing else going on, and borne down on it. And I don't know when that's going to happen, if ever, in my life. So, you know, how much of it is just kind of schmaltz, and how much of it is, you know, of some interest, the way, you know, the best of Gil Evans might be.
Yeah, I don't think any of it is schmaltz, but it doesn't, it's just pleasant. But then when that final cut, The Bond,
right,
I could hear that song all day long. I love that song to death, because it's what I've come to associate with certain orchestrated chord building jazz. I love stuff that builds and builds. I like the release of tension, and that just builds and builds and builds. And again, it's not a shredder. It's just unbearable band. 6 minutes of lush orchestration with him just noodling ever so more urgently over the course of it. And I dig the shit out of it. So I do like this album. But man, oh man, you know, it's put it on in the background and lay down with your heart's desire, because you're in for 2 hours of soft focus, Vaseline lensed happiness. I mean, here's a perfect emblem of the album, right? He could have picked any song off of Breakfast at Tiffany's, right? He picked Henry Mancini's The Search for Cat. Thank you. a sort of instrumental noodling where George Peppard and Audrey Hepburn are looking for that fucking cat in the alley. That's the song he chose to cover. He didn't choose to cover Blue Moon or whatever, right? What's the song? Moon River. He didn't choose to cover Moon
Which
River.
Which itself is pretty chill. Yeah, well, right. I just think it's... Right. I mean, the only question is this an interesting chill album or a dull one? I mean, it's not going to be anything else. And like, you know, we talked about this many, we did a episode on strings and saxophones. And, Art Pepper's Winter Moon, the string arrangements are very rudimentary, basic backgrounds. But, you know, in his late career, Pepper has got such a cry in his sound that the tension between that kind of bluesy sound, that very intense emotional sound he gets, and the strings makes the record work. It's compelling throughout, even though it is a late night chill album. So it's a great example of that genre, whereas you get a lot of ones that are pleasant to listen to, but they don't have that tension, and they kind of just, they're wallpaper. So I'm not quite sure where I fall on the question there. But yeah, I mean, we know Nels can be noisy. We know he does an amazing album covering Andrew Hill pieces, which I quite like. And he's the Nels Klein Singers or whatever. He's made a lot of, you know, just fun, challenging records. And again, if we're going to talk about Blue Note, the label, neither this nor Kenny Barron is meant to knock you off your recliner, right? You know, they are fairly, there's a couple avatars on the label that push things a little bit. I'd say if nothing else, you can say Ambrose Akinmusire is trying to challenge you a bit. It's not frightening. It's not Cecil Taylor doing Conquistador, but it's got a little bit of an edge to it. But mostly, Blue Note is not in the business at this point. And I don't know that it ever was, particularly, but I mean, the immediacy and the texture and the in-your-faceness of the recordings of the classic Blue Note sessions, you know, kind of give even the ordinary ones a certain presence and immediacy and urgency that, you know, later Blue Note tends to lack. Are we ready to move on to this last?
Yeah, let's do it.
Okay, so this is, wow. You know, this on the face of it, back in the old days when we weren't podcasting and we weren't talking about things because they might be of interest or because someone suggested or they fit in a theme, and I just like bought records I wanted to buy. I remember those days. There is no way in hell I would have picked this up. Because you kind of know that the Blue Note All-Star record is aesthetically a very suspect thing, right? You get a bunch of people that happen to be on the same label in a room together and say, make a record, and that's not the way jazz generally works. So this is a lot of the contemporary people on Blue Note, the big names. We've got your Robert Glasper on keys. We've got your Ambrose Akinmusire on trumpet. Marcus Strickland on tenor saxophone. I can't say his name right. Lionel?
I don't know. I just would say Lionel Lukey, but it's not Lionel Lukey.
It is not Lionel, because, I mean, as a kid, I love Lionel Trains, and I heard his name and said, dude, you're not saying it anyway.
Okay, I didn't know. My apologies I don't know how to say his last name. Lueke? I have no idea.
Well,
anyway.
you're going to get closer to the target than I am. And then Derek Hodge and Kendrick Scott on drums. We're looking at guys born mid to late 70s, early 80s. Lionel's 73, Glasper 78, Ambrose 82. I did not look up the rhythm section.
Right. So these are guys who are now, who 10 years ago were the young lions and are now established young lions. Akinmusire now has 3 or 4 or 5 albums out.
Oh, yeah. Right, right.
Glasper
right.
has 3 or 4 or 5 albums out. So they're all, you know, they're leaving the early part of their careers and heading, all of these guys are heading into like their major middle phase.
And I say of the headliners, Strickland, I he's been around. I don't know that Strickland has a strong identity for me. Ambrose, I think of as a left wing. He is the Greg Osby of this era. The very serious, cerebral musician that Blue Note feels like they need at least one on the roster, maybe two, that's plenty. And then they're done. Glasper has been much more interested in crossover efforts.
Right.
And my favorite performance by the guitar player whose name I cannot pronounce correctly, we'll call him Voldemort, was I saw him at a Herbie Hancock gig. You know, Herbie's still doing the jumping, doing the splits I told you about. This is a while back in Indy. And this is a guy that just, he has a lot of fun just shredding old school guitar ways. But he's also known for singing, for playing African styles on the guitar. And, you know, he's also, he's done stuff with like Dave Holland. He's very much, I don't want to say the Yo-Yo Ma figure, but somebody who does very accessible and crossover stuff and his artsier stuff. He's kind of the bridging figure. Whereas, you know, I guess, I think of Glasper as someone who's very much interested in doing the populist side, and Ambrose is obviously deeply committed to the artsiest, brow-furrowing, abstract wing of jazz. And Lionel, if that's the way you say his name correctly, and I apologize, dude. A fantastic musician whose name I'm just butchering. Is kind of, for me, the bridging figure, the guy that plays in both those camps. And Marcus Strickland seems like a nice young man. I don't know that much about him. So, yeah, this is a long, sprawling double album of a CD. There are a couple big nods to Blue Note's past, specifically that embodied by Wayne Shorter, who guests on one track. With Herbie Hancock himself. What do you think of the Blue Note All-Stars, Our Point of View?
And I will just say before we get started that I looked it up, and as far as I can tell, I don't know how you say his first name, but his last name is pronounced Luke.
Luke,
that
okay.
Doesn't sound right to me because he's from Benin, and he's a good 10 years older than most of these guys. So...
Right,
who
knows? Five older than Glasper.
I just looked it up, and I'm like, that none of that.
Right.
I don't know if that's true. That's what the internet tells me. So.
Yeah, I think the elder. I did not look up Derek Hodge and Kendrick Scott's ages, and I apologize for that. Guys.
Yeah, Scott and Hodge are in the pocket with the other guys. They're around the same age. I actually found myself liking this more than I thought I was going to. I came into this thinking, okay, here we go. This is gonna suck, but
Yeah, lowered expectations, as they used to say.
I had lowered expectations, and I kind of liked it more than I thought I was going to like it. I'm not sure about some of the longer numbers.
I am. Okay.
Yeah. I'm not sure they needed to be that long. So this album comes in at an hour and a half. Is it a two-disc set? I guess it must be.
You know, it's a download, but I think, yeah, it might be two or three records, and I think it's two CDs, yeah.
Yeah, I pretty much my feelings can be summed up. I like everything under 10 minutes and everything over 2 minutes. So that leaves out Bruce's vibe and all of I tell the class what Bruce's vibe is, because you can explain this better than I can.
Well, you know, he was, I think, the previous head honcho at Blue Note. And they just have a little background music with him addressing some kind of convention where he's saying, you know, if people ask you if jazz is dying, just be oblique and quote W.C. Fields and tell them to go fuck themselves, which is a cute little bit.
Yeah, I don't mind the 10-minute songs, the 5-minute songs. The longer stuff, I start to wonder why. It feels like it's going on a little longer. I felt, and you may have already addressed this, I felt like Glasper was the wild card here, in the sense that this feels like a more or less kind of in the pocket date of these guys doing a supergroup, you know, Young Lions supergroup thing. And Glasper's interventions, especially when he's twiddling the knobs on the you know, geekier end of electronica, felt real envelope pushing. I don't know if it was an envelope that I wanted pushed.
Well, especially in the context of classic Blue Note, right? I mean, he is the odd sound. So, because the rest of the group, for the most part, I mean, the guitar is a little bit edgy, but it's just Blue Note, a lineup from 1958, right?
Yep. Yeah. And it was especially noticeable on Mascalero, which is second great quintet era song. What's it from? Sorcerer or something, or Nefertiti? And so you get him really going out on the electronics, because Herbie's got the keyboards locked down on that number. And I guess as I think about it, I kind of like Glasper's provocations here, because I felt like they pulled this a little bit like Taffy, and I thought that was helpful. So anyway, yeah, I felt like this was, for the most part, a pretty effective in-the-pocket date with Six Stars that I enjoyed when Glasper sort of pulled it a little bit askew. I thought that was useful. And I think maybe I like Ambrose here more than on any other album I've heard him on. Maybe because this setting, he's not driving the bus.
He's not thinking so hard either.
I feel like he's playing. And, you know, again, I've said this every time we've reviewed an Ambrose Akamuzure album. I feel like I'm just not competent yet to grab that guy's sound. Like, I dig it, but I'm not quite there. You know, I need to listen to him more. But here, I felt like he was more in an idiom that I sort of recognized, which made him a little more approachable for me as a player. And I thought he seemed a little more urgent and engaged, or at least he was more engaging to me. Maybe that's the way of putting it. This setting helped me enjoy him more than I have on other albums. Let me put it that way. And that's a good thing. That's a good thing, because I think he's a major voice. I think he is going to be a major player to kind of keep an eye on in the coming years. And I kind of want to be all in early and kind of get somewhere with this voice and understand it. And I felt like I got somewhere more on this album with him.
Yeah, well, very much the Blue Note. Like I said, he is the Greg Ausby of this generation. He's at his best when he's not overthinking things too much, which was Ausby, you know, my favorite Ausby recordings, as I've said before, of the live one, where he's just a little looser because, I mean, they're both technically very impressive, but they both tend to kind of think themselves into a corner sometimes and just get a little bit too abstract and not intuitive enough. And yeah, in this setting, I mean, it's, as I said, there's kind of the classic Blue Note vibe with a very specific, the covers are both Wayne Shorter tunes of a certain vintage, and one goes over 15 minutes and one is a little shorter. And, you know, they're, for me, part of my ears perk up because, like, oh, I know these tunes, right? You know, it's like, I'm familiar with these, whereas the rest of the program is our originals. And there are moments where it kind of wanders into world music a little bit, and it, you know, it's not, I have a sense more of, in some cases, Out of the Blue, which I never got into, which was like an earlier version of an all-star group, completely different personnel, of course. There's been a couple of these. Here, I feel like the leaders are old enough that they have fairly defined identities. It's more a bunch of guys that have their own things together rather than some attempt to make a homogenous group, like a boy band or the Monkees or something, out of jazz musicians that Blue Note engineered. It's more like these guys are already well along their careers. We're sticking them together in a room, and so-and-so gets to drive the bus on this number, and then somebody else takes over on this one. I will say at times, especially in the longer numbers. I just got a little bit fatigued. I think that maybe there's just a little too much blowing, and maybe at times the feeling that while they're all showing off, they aren't necessarily saying a lot. It's more like, okay, well, I'm going to take my turn, but not a sense of kind of an organic energy, more just kind of people rotating in line. I looked up, and there are a couple of pretty bitter people on Amazon about this record. I mean, like you, I felt like it was stronger than I was afraid it could be a real train wreck, or just really dull or really bland. And it's not. I mean, I think it may be because these guys are full grown men, and they are all men. They don't get trapped. It's not like Don was is their Svengali, right? You know, it's guys that have their things going that get in a room together. But by that same token, it's not quite like they're a great group. It's more like they're a bunch of very talented guys playing together. But I didn't get the sense that, like, this is a group that has a group identity or a group strength. It's more like, well, you know, we're going to do a little bit of this or that. And, you know, each guy's going to kind of strut his stuff.
Yeah, I will say, sorry, I'm going to just sound like a complete trivial idiot because you've been saying important and useful things. I like the cover a lot.
Okay.
It looks like a Quentin Tarantino still from like Reservoir Dogs. It's like six guys walking and they look really cool. And I look at the cover and I'm like, yeah. It's an all-star cover. I don't know. What did you think about? So here's the other thing that I thought was kind of interesting. I couldn't hear. I do think it's pronounced Luke. I'm going to go with that. And if I'm getting it wrong, someone tell me. I think it's Luke. I think Freedom Dance is his number. I think that's the one he composed. My sense of that number is that it's a kind of a feature for him, and it's more world music major key-y than anything else. Besides being a feature for him, I felt like, this is another example, I felt like it was another place where I could hear Ambrose a little more clearly, a little more engaged, and a little more urgent. And again, it's an idiom that's not like his.
Right.
I don't think of him as a world music guy.
No.
The other thing to say is the rhythm section is tight, right? I mean, apart from Glasper doing weird things, Kendrick Scott and Derek Hodge are rock solid throughout all of this. And since they're playing different guys' compositions, that's kind of helpful. I mean, it's obvious Kendrick Scott can do anything. So that they're locking all of this down with composers as mixed as this group is pretty cool. It's pretty useful. But I didn't feel like they were very much featured. Did you? They didn't foregrounded in any significant way. Not that they're irrelevant. They're essential to the proceedings, but they're just not the focus.
And, you know, once or twice, like on the shorter cover, I felt like the horns leapt forward a bit, and it was like, okay, they're almost imitating the old Rudy Van Gelder sound of the late 50s, early 60s.
Yeah.
But yeah, I don't feel like jazz recording has progressed necessarily since then, and that there is a sense that it wasn't as bad as some of the 90s stuff. And of course, it's MP3s. I don't know what it would sound like in a different version or whatever, but, you know, just it could be a little more vivid. It could be a little more textured. It could be a little bit more like human beings and less like Samal Crumbs in terms of just the presentation in sound. Not that it's a bad sounding record. It's certainly very professionally done, you know, but just maybe the corners are smoothed off a little bit more than they need to be. And I'm not somebody who's looking for audio verite, rough edges in your face. And I'm happy with production, quote unquote. It's just, there's always a question of where do you draw the line? And, you know, it's right. A little more regressive than I would have liked there.
And I will say, at least on the strength of this, I'm interested in Strickland. I don't have anything by him, and I believe the only thing I know him from is that he's featured on a couple of numbers, or maybe just one number on Pursuance by Lakeisha Benjamin.
Mm.
And on the strength of this, I'm like, okay, how do I not know who this is? How have I not heard this guy? I have nothing by him. So I feel like I need to kind of dig into, there's enough of Strickland here that makes me think, okay, this is worth looking into. I need to know more about this player. So
yeah,
that was useful.
Right. Yeah.
If you're going to have these dates, it's always going to be good to find out about somebody new. And I definitely did that with this. I'm like, who is Marcus Strickland? And I'm like, someone I don't know, and I probably should. So
yeah. Not somebody that looks like he recorded for Fresh Sounds. It's been called Strick Music, and moved to Blue Note in the mid 2010. So I've not heard either of these releases, but he's not been with the label forever. So he may be the up and comer of this group. Though he's not a kid. He's 40. Something. So, but yeah, it certainly was better than it could have been as an all-star jazz day.
Yeah.
It didn't triumph over that, you know, it didn't become a work of genius or a spectacular success, but it, you know, it works. There's content there. It's not, I say every now and then I felt like I'm kind of getting fatigued here. I had trouble listening to it in the car, and I think it's just, there's a sense of kind of, it doesn't quite catch organic fire sometimes. Sometimes it just sounds like people are kind of straining to get something said, but they aren't quite gelled yet. But I mean, that's the story of all-star groups. Well, we've talked about something old and something new and something borrowed and something blue, and we'll try to, it may not happen next episode, but we're going to try to look at a couple suggestions from our listeners and maybe also talk about our favorite three or five albums that we've talked about on this podcast from the last decade. Just recommendations from those 150 or so records that we talked about on the next episode, and maybe just throw in a couple of random things. Who knows?
Okay.
I might be a part of this ripple on water from a lonesome trip, a fallen tree that witnessed me, him alone, him and me. And that life itself could not aspire to have someone be so admired. I threw creation to my kin with a silence broken by a whispered wind. All of this can be broken, all of this can be broken.
But for now, do you have any pop matters on your mind?
I'll mention a couple of things. You know, everything is just at this point because I'm traveling, I'm not at home, and I'm not at my chief site for acquiring music, which is the public library, because they throw fine things away only a couple of years after they've been released, and I get them for a quarter a pop. So I'm just recycling, you know, I'm traveling with my music. So there are things that we may have talked about before that are now cycling through. And I will mention, I have now had another crack at Laura Marling's I Speak Because I Can. You're All In on these incredibly boring, folky female singers. I still don't give a shit. I've listened to this now twice. I don't get why you care. You love this stuff. And I just, it's,
well,
like,
well, once I was an eagle. That's the one that I'm now.
I eventually got down with, you know, the Beach Boys Pet Sounds, not the many iterations that you have, but I'm still not there on Laura Marling and some of these other.
Okay. Very different artists, but okay. Yes,
you get these bees in your bonnet and you love them. And I listen to them. I'm like, what the fuck?
Better
I just,
a bee in your bonnet than a badger in your pants. That's all I got to say.
Whatever. And then two other things. There's a whole bunch of stuff in the hopper, but I'll mention two, mostly because I want to complain. I am one of those people who did not get on the Elliott Smith bandwagon when he first appeared, and I only listened to him.
That will help.
Yeah, I only listened to him after his suicide, and although I find him pleasant enough, I don't get the rabid worship of his oeuvre. I find him okay. I don't find him mind-blowingly important or compelling, and yet it is sacrilege to say this in certain circles because he's regarded as some kind of...
He's the Nick Drake of our generation, my boy.
And I'm like, who the f... I just don't care. I don't... he doesn't do it for me. Does he do it at all for you?
You know, I haven't listened to him for a long time. I think what I remember of Elliott Smith is there's a line in one of his albums where he's like, I'm the shit you sweep off the street after the parade. And I said, you know, okay, dude. Yeah, life sucks, but I'll go back to listen to Pet Sounds again. So there's certainly a couple catchy songs, but yeah. Oh, his cover of Because. I love his cover of Because. You know, the Beatles song he does. Yeah, I like that one.
Yes. You know, there's a handful of songs by him that stick with me, and the rest, it's all like falsetto whining, and I don't know. I'm not that depressed. I don't know. It doesn't work for me. And then also back into the rotation recently is something you hooked me up with some time back, Fleetwood Mac's Alternate Tusk, which just goes to prove that the finished take is better than the alternate. I do like Alternate Tusk, but Tusk is one of the great albums of all time. And Alternate Tusk is like Tusk without all of Lindsey Buckingham's bells and whistles added. And Tusk is an album that requires bells and whistles. So I much prefer Tusk to Alternate Tusk. But I don't like them equally. I do like Alternate Tusk, but every time I hear it, when I'm listening to it, I'm like, okay, this is good. But I miss all the extra stuff. I like the extra stuff. I like all the stuff that Lindsey Buckingham did when he just, you know, took the album away from the band and then added shit. I like all the added shit.
Yeah, I guess I like, you know, the immediacy of it. There's just a kind of... Anyway, I like them both a lot. Yeah, good stuff.
So that's my stuff. I don't, you know, there's some other things, but it's all recycling at this point. Until I get back on the West Coast, it won't be anything... real new, because I'm not picking up stuff because I don't want to carry it across the country at this point. So.
So this isn't, I don't know if it quite counts as pop, but I've been going back and forth from Champaign, Illinois, and there's a record store that has a lot of 70s ECM and CTI stuff. And so I picked up for the first time and listened for the first time to the first two records by the Pat Metheny Group, which was, you know, an organization I was kind of, in terms of jazz criticism, discouraged from listening to, and I never really got. You know, I... Metheny's 8081, I've got his collaboration with Ornette Coleman, I've got other trios, but I never listened to the album he did with Jaco Pastorius, his debut there, Bright Size Life, which is a pretty good record. But I never listened to these, and the first one I like pretty well. The second one, American Garage, is his thing is how much can you take of Lyle Mays, right? The keyboard player who died fairly young, fairly recently, and kind of had left music a while back, but he was the collaborator with Metheny in this group, and he did a lot of the compositions. And, you know, they'll work up a lather. You know, Metheny will get going on some of these tunes. So there's a lot of melody and fusion-esque trappings, and, you know, it's not all about improvisation and interplay, but there is quite a bit of that. And then I think what puts people off are some of the synth patches that Mays uses as sounds, which are just a little bit, I don't know, too vanilla, too white bread sounding, too cheerful, too superficial. And then, especially on American Garage, he tends to like to end songs on this major key, da-da-da-da, you know, like, here's the tonic, and it's just like, okay, you know, the whole point of jazz is you never end on the tonic, right? You know that, right, Lyle? You know, it's not hip to end on, you know, the major note, you know, the final note of like C major, you know. So there's a kind of earnestness about it that is refreshing sometimes, and it's a little off-putting sometimes. I enjoyed it more than I thought I would. So I got the first one, which is just Pat Metheny Group, And then I got American Garage. They sound pretty good. They're not quite at the peak of the ECM stuff I've been getting. I mean, some of it's just sinful. It's just like, okay, I don't know if the music's good here, but this is just like wallowing in some kind of like, I've got a bathtub full of lotion. I'm going to smooth around in it, you know, the bass frequencies kind of stuff. But there's that aspect to it. It's not probably as quote unquote beautiful or shimmering as some of ECM stuff. And, you know, Metheny, I don't know, he's an odd dude. I mean, he's talented, but sometimes you feel like he's playing, but he's not, it's not quite emoting. It doesn't quite, it's something otherworldly about it. He's got a little, like, E.T. in him. You know, he's not necessarily great at conveying human emotion other than this kind of exaltation. Maybe it's got to do with that hair, that cumulus hair. And May's very much, yeah, there's a lot of major key shit going on. If you're looking for some major key stuff, this is your group. So I don't know if it's fair to call it pop music. There are aspects of it there. I can see how it was a great bridge for people, you know, as of a certain generation, roughly my generation, to get into jazz. But for whatever reason, that's not one of the bridges I took. And I've not listened to this stuff before. But, you know, there's certainly value there. I don't think it's certainly not commercial crap or something. I mean, I never, you know, it's just that there are also these sounds and moments that are just a little embarrassing if you're a hipster jazz fan. And as I said, by American Garage, it's like, dude, the Tonic is great, but come on, let's not land on it every time. You know, it's just a little odd. It's a little bit like jazz meets the Saturday morning school special. And we've all learned to love one another and brush our teeth. So it's just a weird mix. You know, in a way he was known for having Metheny, a very Midwestern vibe that he brought to jazz, and you know, that's almost there in spades. So anyway, that's as poppy as I got this last couple of weeks. And that concludes Jazz Bastard Podcast 204. As always, you can look us up on All About Jazz. You can look me up on Facebook. Or you can email pat@jazzbastard.com or, God help you, mike@jazzbastard.com. The podcast can be downloaded from www.jazzbastard.com, from Stitcher, from Mixcloud, from Apple Podcasts, and it can be streamed at All About Jazz. We decided we'd take a brief break from the Best of 2010 series and look at some brand new releases from 2020. So next time we're going to talk about works by Aaron Burnett, Kasperi Sarakoski, Julia Carosi, Chad McCullough, and Mariel Bildstein. Until next time, take care.